I'm delighted to be joined in studio by Maria McGrain. Maria is from Sheriff Street in Dublin, and she grew up in a sweet shop, living the dream. Her parents ran Matty's of Sheriff Street from the 1950s to the 1970s, Noel and Carmel. And recently, Maria went back to Sheriff Street to photograph the people from there. And her photos are now part of a major photographic exhibition. And Maria joins me in studio. Afternoon, Maria.
Good afternoon to you, and thank you very much for having me in.
Thanks for coming in. So much to talk about. The exhibition, the sweet shop, your parents, Sheriff Street, loads of things. So it's a big day today because the launch is on tonight, is it?
The launch is on tonight, absolutely.
How do you feel?
Yeah, I'm absolutely thrilled to be here. It's been a long journey. It's 4.5 years now in the making. So and COVID, of course, got in the way. So that slowed us down considerably. But I'm absolutely thrilled to be here. We're very lucky, you know, that we got funding and we got a lot of supports, and that's been terrific. And the community themselves have been terrific. They've come out. So the portraits are of adults now, and probably grandparents as well, who were children when they came into, like myself, who were children when they came into my father's sweet shop.
Aha.
Yep.
So let's start the sweet shop then and the history of it.
Oh, the history is really interesting because my great-grandfather and his brother, two Kerrymen called O'Shea, who came up when that area was reclaimed from the sea. It didn't exist, hence the fact that one of the streets is called Newfoundland. Uh-huh. And they came up because they were both carpenters, and there was a great job was available there because they built this church called Lawrence O'Toole's, and they were going to carve all the pews, which they did. And they stayed, and they obviously got married. And somewhere along the way, they turned the bottom part of the house into a sweet shop. And that was passed down through the generations. At one stage, it belonged to my...
And one of them was called Matty. That's where the name came from.
That's where the name... That's what I'm getting to.
Oh, so
My grandfather's brother was... his name was Matty, but he was also known as the deaf man because he was deaf. And so obviously that didn't go very well for quite some time. Then it went to somebody else who was a very generous woman. And if you came in for a shilling's worth of sweets offer, she gave you 2 shillings.
Right.
And her husband said, listen, we have to stop this now because you're not making any profit. And then my mother was in England. They met through being pen pals. And
herself and your dad. Yeah.
Yeah. And they thought they were meeting somebody really exotic because she was asked, would she be a pen pal for this poor, lonely young man over in London? And sure, he was only from across the river in 22 E. Pierce House. They came home and they took over the shop, which was like an old curiosity style shop. And in 1965, then they demolished it and they rebuilt it as this beautifully architect-designed shop with a storeroom and a four-bedroomed house beside it.
So, still selling sweets?
Still selling sweets, but also they sold lots of other interesting things. I have here packets of blades, Wilkinson sword, penny bottles of castor oil, fountain pens for children, fuses,
so soothers. You've gone through all the stuff, anything that was left. Where was this stored?
He kept all the notes. When he left, he obviously loved being a shopkeeper. He kept his money box. He has all the keys. We found all the keys to the shop. We found 62 of these notes from all the mothers because the mothers absolutely loved him. Yeah. One of the locals told me that the thing was that they all thought he looked like Frank Sinatra. They thought he was gorgeous. So they used to come in and see him.
So, when did your dad stop working in the shop?
We left it somewhere between 1978 and 9, I think. I know that I had my 21st in the new house, but we didn't move. There was a kind of tough transition there because the collapse of the docks had already happened. And with that economic collapse, there came a psychological collapse. So it meant that there was a kind of surge in antisocial behaviour, which is always a consequence, I think, of an economic collapse.
We'll take a little tangent then.
Yeah.
So the docks was there and used to service all the ships coming in, and
that's
they used
to
be loaded manually.
Correct.
And then it was sort of automated with ship containers and all that. And as a result, loads of people lost their jobs.
Well, it went from almost overnight, 20,000 people worked on the docks. So it took, I think, a lot of men to, my grandfather, three of my uncles were dockers, they would empty it manually.
Yes.
But when they made the decision to go into containerized shipping, it meant that they only needed 2 men or 4 men to unload
the crane,
a ship, operate the crane. And also the ancillary services didn't need to be beside the docklands. And because of that, and because they could move the goods on wheels on the back of lorries, they all pulled out. And when they all pulled out, it devastated the area. So overnight, almost within weeks, the entire economy was collapsed.
Around Sheriff Street.
Around Sheriff Street, yeah. On the Docklands.
So your dad pulled out sometime in the 70s, but he kept all these mementos of the shop. You brought in a lovely little plastic box full of notes. And I remember this going down, and that actually looks like my mum's writing, but it's not. So you'd be going out to the shop as a kid. Unless I came up to Sheriff Street from Kildare.
Or she was going on the Liverpool boat. Because,
maybe. So you'd get a note from your mother and you'd bring it down, you'd hand it in to your dad, Noel.
That's right, yeah.
And he'd give you. So I'm looking at them. You have your favourites. I'm looking at a lot of sweets. There's one bottle of Sidona, small. One packet of Spud. That'd be Spud's crisps, I say.
I think crisps, yeah.
Yeah, and a quarter Scotch Clans.
Oh, Scotch Clans were lovely.
Yes, they were the toffee covered in chocolate.
That's right. Yeah,
and they would have been sold loose, would they?
All of our sweets, except for boxes of chocolates, they were all sold loose, and we all had to weigh them, and we all had to work there. So I was very lucky that I managed to track down the loan of one of the sweet shops that was made specifically for sweet shops in 1965. And I managed to track down from a chap called Michael Duffy in Parnell Street. He's an antique dealer,
right.
And he's given me a loan of it. And it adds, I think, to the art, because we've done a mock-up shop in the middle of it. And I've managed to get all these big
jars of sweets.
It's in the
CHQ building.
Yeah.
The River Room CHQ building.
Yeah.
And it's starting tonight and it's on till April 9th. Here's another one here. There was a lot of shampoo bought, but they were very specific. Super soft shampoo for greasy hair.
Yes.
Four ice pops, one packet of Twix, or if you haven't, Mars Bar will do. That's that one. And then there's another one, Sun Silk shampoo for normal hair. Says that one. These are great. I love these. Four Pepsi, four Crunchies. I can't. One something pop. Paper Hanks. That's paper handkerchiefs, I suppose.
Yes, that is. Yeah.
10 number six players and 10 Rotmans.
Yeah.
There's the getting the ciggies in, and 10 number six. Sun Silk shampoo for normal hair.
They were obviously going out
of
an evening, yeah. And he also sold the shampoo in sachets, so they didn't have to buy a whole bottle.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Do
you know?
One pair of shoelaces, black. There you go. Two boxes zinc boric starch.
No, zinc boric and starch.
Sorry,
it was for babies, starch, right. for nappies, and he sold a lot of that kind of stuff that you'd need for ordinary everyday life.
Two Viz. What are Viz? Viz was
they
what?
Were bars, I bars, think. Viz bars.
2p packet of sweets, please. Thank you very much. One. There's more. It's all the shampoo. One Sun Silk shampoo, normal hair this time. Yeah. not greasy hair.
They were going up to Talbot Street and O'Connell Street. They call that uptown. We all call that. We're going uptown.
Yeah.
So sometimes you'd go uptown to get your messages, but mostly you'd get them locally.
And you brought in, that's castor oil there. And
Penny
bottle of castor oil. You have blades, as you said. And they're the old
fountain pens.
Yeah, nearly disposable fountain pens, aren't they? In that, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, if the nib broke, you see, they slide out because if the nib broke, you'd be able to buy just the nib and you'd replace it and then you'd dip it into the inkwell in your desk.
What was it like as a child growing up in a sweet shop? Because, as I said, it does sound idyllic. It's the dream, isn't it?
It was the dream, yeah. And my father was very generous. And so even when I was a young adult and I was working in the civil service, before I trained and became a group analyst and a child and adolescent psychotherapist, I'd be heading out at lunchtime to walk back to the Department of Agriculture. And he'd say, help yourself to anything you like. And I was like, oh, it's okay, I've just had my dinner. No, 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 have something. Take whatever you want. And I had that lovely sensation. So the opposite of that did happen. I would eat all the chocolate barrels in the Cadbury's throwouts, they were called. They were the sweets that were kind of slightly second. And I remember the customers would come in and complain that the Cadbury's don't seem to be making those chocolate barrels. And he'd look at me over their shoulders and glare at me. Because I ate the whole lot out of the box.
A couple of things. You don't sound like you're from Sheriff Street.
No. interestingly, when I was 10 years old, my mother tried to get me into a private school. And the first private school turned me down because of where I came from. And the second school, which is now where the Westbury stands, was my school that was in the Holy Faith in Clarendon Street.
Right.
So
when you were growing up, having an address in Sheriff Street was a no-no. Is that
it was
what
a dreadful thing. By the time I was 16, my mother was asking the local priest, could we use that address? And I remember at one stage standing on Seville Place, which was full of bed and breakfast because the boat was at the end where the Samuel Beckett Bridge now is, where the boat pulled in. And so people would board the ship and go up to the upper deck and the cattle would be loaded onto the bottom deck because cattle came up and down our street twice a week. So she realized that she thought that my accent would go against me. And so she paid 5 shillings a week for me to have elocution lessons, right, as well as paying for a private school.
I hear a bit of the Dublin coming through the odd time.
Yeah.
The way you
yeah.
say now.
Now, yes, now. Now.
Now.
Now. Wait till I tell you now.
But on a serious note, you were saying there that you're a psychotherapist and you do a lot around trauma.
Yes.
And you reckon, it's, in your opinion, there's sort of community trauma around the area.
Yes, I do.
Go on.
I think that the collapse of the docks had a massive impact on people. And also, when you have a job, it becomes part of your identity. And if that's taken away from you, well, who are you to yourself and others? And I think people didn't realise that they were quite traumatised. And also, I think it is very traumatising to live in an area where you get related to as a social pariah. And there's a series of talks built in around the photography exhibition. And the one I'll be doing with Roisin Ingle is a talk on the impact of shame on marginalised communities.
Right.
And we know that it has an effect on the right side development of the brain. But we also know that we can, you know, because the brain has plasticity, we know that actually we can change these difficulties that people experience in their lives, and we can help them to overcome them. And I think with chronic shame and societal shame that we're talking about, I think it's really important that people are helped, that others can find empathy for their suffering, and also that they can be helped to find a ladder out of the intergenerational transmission of trauma and out of chronic and societal shame that helps them to move on in their lives. So I think that's generally been acknowledged. I think a lot of people down there know that the collapse of the docks was something horrendous.
And the people who you feature in your exhibition, they're portraits of of people and couples and all that. And they've lived there all their lives.
They have lived there all their lives. Some of them have moved away. The one thing that's very striking is, and it's in my memory, is the sense of community that I lived within. So even though people wouldn't have much, you know, because maybe a lot of the fathers were away, they might have been at sea, the check wouldn't have come on time, the children might be hungry. And so the mother next door, who wouldn't have much, would actually take those children in and the woman and feed them. So because it was highly industrialised, there was also a lot of traumas that happened. There was men, and there was no health and safety. Men were killed on the docks, children were drowned in the canal. But everybody would pull together. Right. And I think they're a kind of, they're an example of exactly what can happen. We can be overwhelmed by trauma, and we can be devastated. But if we have a community where we're loved and supported and we're helped, we can get through it. And one woman came to us, and she was only 6 days over heart surgery. And she came with a little picture of her brother, Bill, who had drowned in the dock. And I was there the day he drowned. And but her father had died a few months before, and the mother realised she was pregnant. And women didn't run down there, and I saw them all running. And my mother shouted, "What's wrong?" And they said, "There's a boy gone into the canal." So we all ran in the same direction. And it was her brother, and she said, "I just want him remembered."
Oh.
So we've got a little memorial in the portfolio to him, beside her photograph, because we couldn't fit everybody on the wall, because I think I did over 70, myself and Linda did over 70 portraits. So some of them are in the portfolio. We've also recorded them, so we've taken a multimedia approach. I like that. It makes me sound very technical, and I'm very proud of that.
This is a great community event, isn't it?
It's a huge community event. And a woman phoned me last night, one of the participants, and she said, because I was saying to her, "You're the VIP of the evening." She said, "No, you are, because you've brought us all back together again." Because the whole community, really, after the collapse of the dock, scattered. Now, the other thing I want to say is, what's very clear to me is the sense of community still exists, and anybody who left took it with them. And the people who are there, it lives on in them, because actually it's not a place and it's not a building. It's the soul.
People, yeah.
It's the soul of the people.
Okay, yeah.
And they are that. And they're funny and witty, and they're all kinds of things. They're extraordinary.
The Pride of Place photography exhibition, it's at the River Room in CHQ building from tonight onwards. Good luck with the launch, Maria, and thanks so much for coming in. Thank you
so much, Ray.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.